Hear my words and bear witness to my vow. Night gathers, and now my watch begins.
Beware, spoiler phobes. You have stumbled upon a storm of spoilers, a podcast about HBO's Game of Thrones series in conjunction with the Song of Ice and Fire books by George R.R. Martin. It is Rethrone season as we rewatch the 6 previous 10-episode seasons of Game of Thrones in preparation for Season 7 hitting HBO this July. It's highly recommended you catch up with the show as we go along, and our local book experts will also be cherry-picking literary and adaptation nuggets as we march towards a new, spoilable season of Game of Thrones.
The Realm. Do you know what the Realm is? It's the thousand blades of Aegon's enemies. A story we agree to tell each other over and over till we forget that it's a lie.
But what do we have left once we abandon the lie?
Chaos. A gaping pit waiting to swallow us all. Chaos isn't a pit. Chaos is a ladder.
Hello and welcome to the Storm of Spoilers. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and I have not read any of the books in George R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire series.
I'm Joanna Robinson, and I've read every book in George R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I've read all of those books too, along with a lot of Wikipedia articles.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I guess the Wikipedia articles and the Reddit pages, that's all going to come into play later on in our coverage of Game of Thrones. You have stumbled into Rethrones, our rewatch of the Game of Thrones seasons leading up to the new season in July. We're going to do a season per episode over the next 6 weeks. This is not going to include anything that is going to be spoilery for the 7th season without a whole bunch of warnings beforehand, so you don't have to worry about that. We're back into Game of Thrones, where we've settled into our citadel and are checking on our ravens. Joanna, do we have any reviews?
We do. We have a couple, two, that I wanted to read. One is very short, and it is from Stevo62301, 5 stars. The title is Guys, 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 ellipses. That's the title. And then the body of the review is, there was a Beastmaster 2 reference during their off-season tour. 5 exclamation marks, 5 stars. So,
yes.
Thanks, Steve-O. You're my kind of person.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
And then I'll read this other one from a listener called Starts With a J. At 5 stars, off-season tour in Tarot Bang is the headline. I'm ashamed to say that I stopped listening after the end of the last season of Game of Thrones. I missed a lot, apparently. Not only are they talking about Marvel stuff, but I'm also able to listen to them to help me make sense of the sometimes confusing American gods. During the regular season, I have a weekly tradition. I listen to a cast of kings hosted by one of the hosts from the show, Joanna Robinson and David Chen. I then go check the Storm of Spoilers feed to see if that feed has a new episode so their magical voices can fill my head with spoilery goodness. And then there's just a lot of stuff about me. And then it says, TLDR, this trio has awesome chemistry and great conversation about Game of Thrones and also other topics during the off-season. Don't make my mistake and stop listening during the off-season.
I love that that review is basically, you know, the gif from Community of Donald Glover walking back into the apartment that's on fire. Like, that's what that guy experienced when he realized that we had an off-season tour.
Oh, but it's the opposite, because, like, that's bad news, but this is, like, whatever the opposite of the room being on fire would be, right?
Maybe.
It's the not darkest timeline.
It was an interesting experiment for sure that I'm sure will continue in between Game of Thrones. But I think I speak for all of us when I say that it was super fun to get back into this universe. Even though, Joanna, I wanted to stop a moment and let people get us like an idea of how busy your summer is going to be. What shows are you currently recapping?
Well, American Gods is almost over. Very soon. Twin Peaks and Game of Thrones. That's about it.
Yeah. I mean, just Twin Peaks and Game of Thrones.
I have to be ready to write about The Leftovers in Fargo at a moment's notice. And yeah, anyway, I mean, but it's my
job.
Yeah,
and like, you aren't like helping plan any conventions or any.
Listen, guys, now that we've launched now that Vanity Fair has launched its Star Wars cover, my life is going to get exponentially easier. So.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, go to StarWars.com. You can go there, but you should go to VanityFair.com and see the Star Wars coverage that, like, made my life kind of a living hell for a little while. But now it's up for everyone's enjoyment. Yay!
Yay, so. It's got a bunch of pictures.
I enjoyed that
everybody
period
cry.
Of your life. Yeah, no, and there was also, like, late-night chats from Joanna asking about the color of kyber crystals. And, you know, that's always nice.
Oh, yeah, I squeezed Dave dry of Star Wars, arcane Star Wars knowledge to help me out. It was really, Dave's just the best. Neil is also the best, but maybe not quite as obsessed about Star Wars as Dave is, so.
Yeah, I'll take it.
Well, now it's about to go back. It's about to go back the other way, where you guys have all the textual knowledge, and I'm flailing around in Crazy Town, being like, "What sigils are? Oh man, what rewatching
yes.
season one?
Sigils.
It was crazy, yeah." And the houses and the way they try to world build in between. But I'm getting way ahead of myself because there's even bigger Game of Thrones news this week. We got the season 7 trailer that is chock full of trailer goodness,
and
Neil.
Maps.
And maps, which I was psyched about. There's at least 2 maps, maybe 3 maps. I am very happy about Westerosi cartography, in part because I think it's been a while since the show has tried to stop and re-world build about the overall stakes, but not important. Neil, you broke this down for Film School Rejects, and Joanna broke it down for Vanity Fair. I did not break it down, so let's start with Neil. What's the big takeaways from the season 7 trailer?
Sure. Before we get into this, I have something to say.
Yeah.
I would like to just take a moment and pour one out for the fact that you can't say off season 2.
I was about to say that. I wanted to say that earlier when you started the intro and you didn't say
it. It was very weird.
My heart was like, I miss it.
I know. I miss it already.
Season 2. Maybe you can say it just for us, Dave, and then edit it out later. No? Okay.
We all just have to get back into the swing of things.
Weird. It's like we couldn't go back and listen to those episodes and hear him say it. Anyway, this Game of Thrones trailer is interesting. As you mentioned, numerous maps. Also, a bunch of locations that we've seen already, which I thought was fascinating. How we're going to get new perspectives on places like Dragonstone, and we're probably going to get new perspectives on King's Landing, and you know, then there's just a bunch of like woods and stuff. But a very interesting trailer that sets up what I found fascinating about it was that it sets up Cersei as the center of this new war that is coming, the Great War, which we know not to be true. We know the Great War is between the living and the dead. Literally, the last trailer told us that. But as far as Cersei's concerned, she is now surrounded by enemies, and I'll go through it, and then you guys can tell me what you think about this. In the east, right? In the east? Yes. Mm-hmm. In the east, she is flanked by Daenerys and her now humongous army that involves the Unsullied, the Dothraki,
The Dornish. Varys,
the Dornish, some Ironborn. She's basically got like all kinds of people. And they're all wearing 3 dragon brooches, which the 3 dragon thing I'm sure will come in handy later. Stay tuned. From the west, she's got the other Ironborn, because Uncle Euron's still kicking around. And we assume that he's made 100 ships by now. So someone's going to pay the iron price. From the south was an interesting one because it's just somebody sharpening a blade. We have to assume that maybe that's the tip of a spear. There was nothing recognizable about that, but the show doesn't seem very proud of Dorne, so I think we're not going to get a whole lot of that until, you know, maybe deep into a couple episodes.
Or until it's dying time.
Until it's dying time. That's true. And then in the north, they just showed a picture of Arya on a horse in the woods, which I thought was fascinating because it didn't really identify Jon Snow and his ilk as a threat. They sort of have their own thing going on. So that'll be fascinating to see them work that out. But also, I think Arya's not going south. So there's that. And then, of course, For some reason, Cersei is having a map painted on the floor of... I want to say this is the same courtyard where the last time we saw it, the mountain was like...
Yeah, killed those sparrows.
Yeah, so they washed away the blood and they made a really fancy map.
Maybe the blood doesn't wash out and she had to paint over it. She's like, la la la, nothing to see here, just a continent, it's fine.
That would be the most Cersei thing to do. It's like, well, we got to just paint a map over it, it's fine. And then a bunch of other stuff happened. I'm curious as to what you guys thought. Otherwise, I will literally just talk about this for 40 minutes by myself.
Joanna.
Okay. So Neil and I actually agreed that the coolest shot, you know, I rewatched this over and over again, and the coolest shot, the shot that caught my eye over and over again was what Neil likes to call Dothraki parkour. Horse Lord
parkour.
Dave is likening it more to rodeo stunts.
Which is fine. Rodeos are cool.
Yeah, and it did. I mean, you know, Dave's right. When I saw it, it reminded me of that moment in The Magnificent Seven when Denzel Washington does a similar like stunt where he like hops on the side of his horse and rides along for a while. And I like as soon as I thought about that, I was like, because I got so excited. I was like, this episode we're gonna be talking a lot about season one where the Dothraki are great, and then they haven't. It's like make the Dothraki great again. They have not been great since season one. But then as soon as I thought of that Denzel Washington thing, I was like, but that movie was pretty trash. So one great horse stunt does not whatever make. But we do know, or we think we know, that we're going to see a big battle with, and this trailer backs it up, with Dothraki and Ironborn and blah, 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 and everyone fighting each other. And so to see the Dothraki...
And a bunch of Lannister soldiers dying.
Oh, yeah. And
that's
so
all over the trailer.
To see the Dothraki sort of fighting... More than, you know, the 2 seconds that we got at the Battle of Meereen, where they just sort of like stormed up to a doorway and that was it, is kind of exciting. And but the more significant scene, I mean, I'm like, should we spoil things? And I'm like, wait, we're out in Storm of Spoilers. the more significant scene to me, I think, is one between Littlefinger and Jon Snow in what appears to be the Winterfell. I mean, actually, is definitely the Winterfell crypts, right next to the statue of Lyanna Stark, which seems to be sort of the moment that we've all been waiting and speculating over, of like, when is Jon Snow going to find out who his real parents are? And it seems like it's going to be Littlefinger's the one to tell him. Like, we had a few candidates. Like, we thought maybe Uncle Benjen might do it. You know, like, we had some ideas, and Littlefinger was definitely on the list. But from that moment in the trailer, it really feels to me like Littlefinger is doing it. And the reason Littlefinger would do it is, I think, even though he's a bastard, not being Ned's son, I think, would destabilize, like, being half-dragon would destabilize Jon's position in the north.
And I have a question, though.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be a more Game of Thrones thing to do, especially what we might call late stage Game of Thrones, which is the more detached from the books thing, for them to have a conversation in front of the Lyanna Stark thing that's completely not about that? for them to just be like, hey, you guys think this is going to happen? It's not happening.
Well, like, maybe, like, they're talking about, you're still about, mad, like, about Clegane Bowl, aren't you? yeah.
I haven't even had time to recharge my anger about that.
It could be, yeah, you're right. It definitely could be. And like, well, how I came to that conclusion is, when I was doing my write-up, I was like, okay, so Arya seems to be heading back to Winterfell, and when she gets there, like, her family's going to be a little fucked up, because obviously we've got Littlefinger pouring poison in Sansa's ear, and we've got Jon fighting with Littlefinger. And then I was like, oh, I wonder why they'd be fighting. Oh, Littlefinger probably just told him some news he's upset to hear about. So, you know, you're right. But at the same time, I do think it's in keeping with Littlefinger's plan to sort of destabilize Jon and prop Sansa up in his place.
Here's another question. Mm-hmm. Arya, do you think, and at this point, I think I'm just a Game of Thrones nihilist when it comes to season 7. Do you think that they would dare have Arya show up after Jon had, like, left to go off somewhere else?
1,000% I do.
Yeah.
Because they're like, we can save that reunion for 8.
Right. Because how dare they? Why would they have a reunion between two characters who had actually spoken to each other on screen before? Crazy.
versus Sansa and Jon, who like had no relationship. Right. Yeah.
But also, do you think Arya is just going to try and murder Sansa the first time she sees her? Because I don't remember them having a good time ever.
Well, I mean, yeah, we just rewatched season one. We know that they didn't have a good time, but like, I do think that by the time Arya gets back to Winterfell. And I think she will see Sansa and Bran, and I think that will be a sort of like Stark kid reunion sort of situation. And then their bastard brother will show up in season 8, is my guess. So, yeah, and we're pretty. The Jon leaving Winterfell thing, I don't think we see Jon anywhere else but the North in this trailer, but we do see Melisandre at Dragonstone. So.
Right, watching some sort of indiscriminate figures, nondescript figures walking toward Dragonstone, which could be Targaryen people, could be someone else that she would want to keep an eye on.
Right.
We don't know.
Dave, what were your takeaways from the trailer?
Basically all those things. I'm trying to think about what we're missing out on. I remember just initially being psyched that we're going to see more of Dragonstone, which I knew, but especially since they are including the map room, which we've seen before, and previously that was like
the
all of Dragonstone.
The dopest table in all of Westeros.
You mean
the map room table
Stannis'
in Dragonstone.
Fuck pad?
Yeah.
There was a smoke baby made on that map. but we're getting ahead of ourselves. There's Sir Robert Strong, right? That's what we're calling Zombie Mountain?
Uh-huh.
And sure. He's got cool new black armor.
Yeah,
which I think in the show though, in the show they don't. He's just still Gregor.
I think they used his name, but I could be wrong. Go ahead.
And then we got an arm that we've all decided is Jorah pre getting whatever help he's going to get.
If he's going to get help.
That has grayscale crawling down his forearm and over his knuckles. It looks a little slimy. I don't remember grayscale being.
Yeah, it looks like it's drooling.
Like maybe he's like in the midst of a cure. You know how like when cancer patients, they give you chemo, you look way worse because chemo like kills a bunch of cells in your body. So like maybe this is like Westerosi chemo where like it looks worse and then it just falls off and he's fine.
Westerosi chemo.
But yeah, other than that, we got a big, giant dragon.
Huge dragon. So the big takeaways that I had were huge dragon, sea battle. The other takeaways that I had that I am now forgetting: huge dragon, sea battle. Brienne is in Winterfell. There was something else now that I can't remember.
I think it's a listener. I don't imagine that anyone else would be like Johnny in the spot tweeting at me about Game of Thrones, but I think it was a listener. And I can't remember who at this moment. Sort of sent over the trailer and was like, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't this a show that used to have some subtlety to it? And that's like, it's a pretty harsh take, but I don't know that I can like really disagree with it, because this to me looks like a trailer for the best action movie of the summer. And there's nothing wrong with the best action movie of the summer necessarily, but you know, we'll get into it as we talk about season one, but especially in light of season one, which was a lot of like moody character scenes, the, oh, that dragon's big. Oh, there's fire, blah, blah. Oh, I zombies, like that the show has become. It's not a bad show. It's just such a different show. And
right.
I think
the show used to have 3 more episodes per season and like 150 more important characters.
Yeah.
That are all dead now.
Yeah. But also the willingness to experiment. Well, I feel like I'm blowing some of my like season one commentary, but like basically for us to be completing this season one rewatch, or in the case of Dave, blowing into season two, right.
Hey, nobody knows that except for you.
Spoiler. you know, and right when the trailer dropped, really just does highlight how much Game of Thrones now is about spectacle, which is something that I whined up a lot about last season. And then people are like, well, you hate the show. Why do you talk about it? And I don't hate the show. It's just, it just is remarkably different. So
that's true. They had to spend four seasons putting the pieces in place, and now we have to watch the pieces do what they were meant to do in the end, and going to happen very quickly.
We don't know that, because I mean, we know that Weiss and Benioff know the bare bones of what George is going to do, but we don't know that they're necessarily going to, like, you know, this is the nature of adaptation. Something I will say, there's a scene in the trailer, right, that I talked about, where Jon shoves Littlefinger up against the wall, and then someone on Twitter pointed out to me that that's exactly what Ned did to Littlefinger outside the brothel, and it's like, it's a pretty close approximation of Ned throwing Littlefinger up against the wall of the brothel versus Jon throwing Littlefinger up against the wall of the crypt, which is a nice, I mean, they do this all the time on Game of Thrones. This is a nice little, like uncle, like son moment, but the... what did I want to say about that? The reaction that I saw, people are like, oh yeah, John's finally going to make Littlefinger pay for what he did in season one. And I'm like,
yeah, no, he's not.
No, he might. He actually, I mean, John might not, but like Littlefinger, I think, is going to get got this season. But maybe I liked Game of Thrones better when it was a show where Littlefinger wins. And it's not the Starks get their revenge on Littlefinger for betraying their dad. Because that's a different show, rooting for the good guys, you know. And this is something we talked about a lot about last season, like Sansa sicking the dogs on Ramsay and stuff like that. And they're like, this is the ebb and flow. First, you have to see them be miserable, and then you get to see them be victorious. And I'm like, yeah, that makes entire sense to me. I'm not saying it doesn't make sense, but you know, the whole reason this show caught so many people's attention in the first place is that it subverted that expected narrative. So I think it's actually a more it's just more traditional to be like, ooh, Littlefinger's going to get got. I think he is going to get got. I will feel some satisfaction when he does, but I will also be like, well, this show used to be, or this story used to be something different, you know?
This is true.
Maybe it did. Let's find out after this break.
It's really fascinating, the perspective that you gain watching season one while preparing for season seven. It's crazy.
Yeah, it might be why I was so cranky last year, because Dave Chen and I did a season one rewatch before season six, and so that was, it was fresh in my mind last year too, when I'm like, this show's so different now.
Right. It is. It's changed. It's evolved significantly in 6 years, 7 years.
Or we could just start right there. Let's do it. Go ahead.
What's interesting to me is that I was reading a Deadline interview with Weiss and Benioff around season one, or season two, maybe. And back when they used to give interviews to other outlets. And they were saying that...
Remember the good old days?
They were saying, I guess their original pitch, like... I bet it was Mike Fleming. Probably Mike Fleming at Deadline was talking to them, and he was like, the last time you talked to me, you were pitching me the series. You're telling me about the series you're going to do, which was The Sopranos and Middle Earth. And like Weiss and Benioff were like, oh, we're so embarrassed by that. Like, that's been haunting us. We don't like that we said that, blah, blah, blah. But that inclination to do The Sopranos, which is not just about like revenge and families feuding, but also these like slow character beats, I think is evident in season one and is less evident the more the show goes on.
So. Yeah, that makes sense. The show has evolved from The Sopranos to Breaking Bad to a Michael Bay movie.
Yeah.
And I say that lovingly.
Sure, I enjoy occasional Michael Bay movie, Pain and Gain.
Right. So yeah, so it's turned into like summer blockbuster stuff. Right. And they're just like, now we have to do all this action at the end because this is what we've been building toward and this is what HBO is paying for. And I'm sure, I think it's interesting you mentioned in the last segment how, you know, we don't really know what George's ending is going to look like. His will probably be more slow.
Yeah.
And not literally because it takes time to read things, but more contemplative, I guess. But for this, before we can get to that, we need to go all the way back to season one, guys, I've prepared for you a recap of things that happened in season one for those of you who were not rewatching it with us. And then Joanna and Dave are going to tell you what I got wrong.
Can you do it in the Micro Machine Man voice?
I wish I could do that. So what we're discovering as we do this, the Rethrones project over the next 6 weeks, is that it's very, very difficult to get 10 episodes of television into one episode of podcast. So I found a way to break them down. For my recap, we're going to do it by the seven children that we consider to be George's children. So these characters who are actually still alive. So here's what happened to Bran in season one. Bran gets pushed out a window, takes a long nap, wakes up, doesn't remember stuff, becomes Lord of Winterfell, has a wolf dream about his dead father. Daenerys Targaryen gets married, or sold off, falls in love, watches her brother die, has a miscarriage, loses her husband, has three dragon babies, and burns off all of her own clothes.
Mm-hmm.
Sansa Stark, the little dove, as she's called, falls in love with Joffrey, lies for him, loses her direwolf, convinces Ned to confess his treason, gets her father killed, faints, tours the Wall of Heads, which at one point included George W. Bush, but does not anymore.
Memories.
I know. Tyrion Lannister, who had a terrible wig in the pilots, but came out flying in the second episode. Tyrion urinated off the wall, got put on trial for a murder he didn't commit, met Bronn, met Shay, leads mountain clans into battle, gets knocked out before the battle, and then gets a new job at the end.
All of that is true, but Tyrion is the one where, like, I want to talk more about all the other things that he did so far, right, of the people,
right,
that you've mentioned.
Okay, cool. Yeah. I feel like we're almost spoiling who is the MVP of the season, but we'll come back to that. Arya Stark starts off by, well, first of all, she gives her sister a dirty look while trying to sew. But then she shoots an arrow, loses her direwolf, learns water dancing from Sirio Forel, kills a stable boy, almost watches her father's beheading, escapes with Yoren, meets Gendry.
Oh, Gendry.
I know, Gendry. Jon Snow. Jon Snow asks about his mother, hangs out with Uncle Benjen, makes frenemies with Sir Alistair, more like enemies, makes real friends with Pip, Gren, and Sam, saves Lord Commander Mormont from a zombie, gets a new sword, has a vow party in the woods with his friends, and heads out to find Uncle Benjen in a very triumphantly scored sequence. One of the better ones in the whole season.
Ain't no party like a vow party.
The significant deaths in season one include a Night's Watch deserter who got beheaded, Westerosi Matt Damon, who got eaten, mostly just killed by a White Walker, one Knight of the Vale who got tossed out the moon door, the Mountain's Horse, who really didn't deserve it, Sir Hugh, who got stabbed in the neck, Sirio Forel, maybe, King Robert, who met the bad end of a boar, Khal Drogo, who we all wish we could have back, Ned Stark, and Innocence itself.
And Viserys Targaryen.
Oh, right, Viserys. See, I dislike that character so much I forgot that he was even there.
I love Viserys. I love to hate Viserys. Yeah.
These people who died are survived by Catelyn Stark, who is sad, Robb Stark, who is brave, Cersei Lannister, who is mean, Joffrey, who is technically king, Jaime, who is captured, Varys, who is almost always telling the truth, Littlefinger, who is almost certainly always lying, Grandmeister Pycelle, who's just creepy, Lysa Arryn, who is an isolationist and a weird breastfeeder in public, which is totally cool, except the way she does it is just not great.
Free the nipple.
Okay. Tywin Lannister, who's significantly more dashing in his armor in the show than he was in the books. Benjen Stark, who is missing. Ser Jorah, who is very handsome. Five kings and three motherfucking baby dragons, who show up right at the end.
Thank you for your very accurate description of Ser Jorah. Thank you for that.
I mean, there's what other way could you describe Ser Jorah?
There's
He's
no other
just
way.
Handsome. He's also, I forgot how much I love the fight between him and the Dothraki guy at the end, like in the last episode or the second to last episode. I don't know. They all run together. So that is your super fast recap of everything that happened in season one for the most part.
Yeah. I think that for me, at least with season one, that is sort of in between the cracks of these are all the things that Longview you would pay attention to for sure. For me, season one is like a murder mystery that has like these world building scenes at the end that hint that there might be magic, but not until the end are they like, fuck yeah, there's magic. There's actually the first scene and like the last scene sort of bookend this medieval politics murder mystery with, hey, magic's real, which
I know it's incredible how little magic there is in the first season.
I mean, I kind of wanted to jump in and say that when you were talking about it around the season seven trailer, which is that I think like they're hinting towards it being like this amazing thing. Like the little we do get of who I think is Old Nan, only because you guys tell me about other stories she's told in the books. Gino tries to scare Bran with things that we now know we'll probably end up seeing on screen because it's a gigantic battle movie now, but
spiders as big as hounds.
Is that the sort of thing you want to hear about, boy?
Want to be scared, Bran?
You little piece of shit.
Now Bran's like, I wish I would have got stabbed. This sucks.
But I'm hoping that this ends up, I mean, there's something about looping in an audience with a murder mystery you could track from episode to episode instead of something like, I don't know, season five of the show, which ends up just being all of us tracking everybody's misery throughout like an episode, but it doesn't feel like anybody does anything really. So I was happy with the forward momentum of these, even if our main characters sort of act like idiots sometimes.
No, I mean, I agree with you. To sort of put it around who killed John Arryn is a great conceit, and that's George's conceit pretty much, right? And Neil was saying before we started recording, like, is season one perfect? And I kind of think it might be.
Well, yeah, because we were in the next segment we're going to do these awards, and we're also going to talk about a lot of like book changes and stuff. But I couldn't find anything that was in the books that I was like, man, I wish they would have done that in the show, because the first season is very faithful and all the stuff that they cut away felt, you know, like stuff that was kind of unnecessary. So like it was just the level of adaptation was really good. And they also did, to their credit, they kept in the right breadcrumbs that would later pay off to be huge things, like the Old Nan stories. You know, they didn't keep them all, obviously, but they kept that part of it in because it was like they were thinking six seasons ahead without knowing that they were going to make six seasons, which is really impressive.
My spiders as big as hounds.
Well, there's like another line that I didn't notice the first time through because why would you? But there's a ton of little asides about history. Like I think it's Ned's talking to Arya, who's just heard of that Bran's woke up but he's paralyzed, and he's like, well, he could still, you know, grow to be a builder like Brandon the Builder. And I'm like, it's just that little aside, and now I'm like, hey, I know about that guy now. But before it was just little world building asides, which I enjoy greatly in season one because you don't know which one of those are going to end up feeding into the mystery and which one of them is just, why do I care what the sigil of all these houses that Bran's getting quizzed on are. But it's all going to end up being important, which makes it just really well structured. I don't know if it's perfect. They're not, with the exception of Tyrion getting conked out so they don't have to shoot the big battle, I don't think it makes the most of point of view if we're spending time with one character for a extended amount of time. I think the show ends up getting better at that, but it does sort of flirt with that with all the Daenerys scenes. Well, I'm just not sure if it gets all the way there.
Can I talk about that's in my first sort of like section that we're gonna get
yeah
to. Can I go
I
to
feel
that?
Like we're there now.
Okay.
Oh well, wait one second, because we have to have another break. All right, we're back. Joanna, continue.
Okay, so the first section of what we want to talk about, constructed very thoughtfully by Neil Miller, is a section called What They Changed what we'd change, what changed us, sort of about the differences between the books and the show, and also
it's the existential crisis segment.
It gets a little bit more like direct and specific later on in this podcast, but this is this is a little more esoteric. And yeah, the biggest one that struck me is that battle scene, the Battle of the Green Fork, where the battle exists in the book, and in the show they knock Tyrion out, and Battle of Whispering Wood is off screen in the book, but it's also off screen in the show. So like, there are no big battles, and that's the thing is like. Now Game of Thrones is famous for its battle episode, right? Like episode 9 or something like that is going to have a big battle, and we're all, you know, who are they fighting this time, and how can they like make it bigger? And we know that from the season 7 trailer that like, and even just from that still that they released of Drogon earlier in the week, it's like they are like, this battle is even Michael Bayer than the last battle, guys.
All of our battles will be on screen.
but season one, they didn't do it because, exactly what you said. They didn't have the budget, so they sort of found a way to get around it. But also, like, they didn't that wasn't the show yet. They didn't need a battle episode. Their big moment is Baelor, and it's rooted in character. You know, it's small. I mean, there's a big crowd scene, but it's small and rooted in character. And
it's told from the point of view of Arya, which is...
And Ned.
Like, the most... Well, sure, yeah. But, like, the most impressive thing about that scene to me was how they brought you into the Arya POV.
Absolutely.
Which I thought was, like, so good.
So good. Anyway, but that's, you know, that's an adaptive change they made for budgetary reasons, but also sort of is telling about what kind of show this show was in its first season versus, you know, and that just ties, I mean, really everything is just going to tie back to what I was rambling about before, which is, like, the ways in which the show has changed significantly. And, you know, a lot of people think or the show has become more of what they want to see. They're excited that the budget is expanding, that the special effects are better and bigger and more amazing. But rewatching this season, I feel like it's moving away from what really, really got me in the first place. So,
And piggybacking off of that, there is one thing that I found that I would have loved to see in the show that actually would have been a good character piece, but it also would have required them showing the Battle of Green Fork. So I copied this from the wiki so that I wouldn't get it wrong. But in the book, Tyrion Lannister is depicted giving a battle speech, which he does in the show, before riding into the vanguard and fighting a knight whom eventually yields. He is also described as wearing a mishmash of armor instead of his custom suit, because his armor is still at Casterly Rock. This causes the audience missing him spearing a horse with a unicorn helm, the only thing they could find that would fit his head. I kind of wanted to see that, and hopefully someday they'll make reference to it, but probably not. But that's how deep I had to go into the weeds to find something where I was like, I do wish that was in the show from the books.
Dave, is there anything... I mean, I know you're not... You don't consider yourself a book reader.
Is that what I like from the books?
No, I know. But, like, is there... I don't know. Any adaptive changes that you've wikied that you consider of note from season one?
I don't think so. I do remember that there was inkling or whispers at some point that the series originally started its King's Landing story with a scene that more directly tied Cersei to the death of Jon Arryn. And I mean, it would have ruined the mystery, but I'm kind of sad that that has been lost to the cinematic ages. Maybe we still get it in a flashback. No, there'd be no reason to flashback Jon Arryn now. Fuck it. It's gone.
How would that ruin the mystery, though, since...
I mean, yeah, we pretty Cersei's much know not. It's Cersei the whole time.
Yeah, that's true.
So, yeah.
Maybe they should have had it.
Wait, but it's not Cersei.
Wait, it was... Well... What?
No,
oh, it's Lysa.
She's Lysa Baelish.
That's right. We find
out
later.
She's just there when he dies, and we figure out, I think, that she's, like, complicit in it somehow. I think is how it was.
She's not complicit, though, right?
I don't think so.
I think it was... I believe that it's Littlefinger and Lysa who kill Jon Arryn, and, like, Cersei is concerned about, like, when you get that scene in episode one, what she's talking to Jaime, her concern is, like, what if he told someone before he died? Like, she knew that Jon Arryn knew something and that it was in her best interest that he was gone, but it's not her... Cersei's not the one who killed him.
Right, because we find out later that it was Lysa. There, that is one of two things that I found in my rewatch of season one that were like, oh, everyone gave up on these ideas. So that seems to have changed, because that scene in the first episode, it's as if they're talking around the fact that they just murdered John Aaron, but we now know that they didn't. The other one is John burning his hand, which I may or may not still hold by the end of the series, but I have a feeling it's possible now that we know he's a Targaryen that he may not be able to be burned as quite as easily, because it's weird that they made such a big deal about that and then he burns his hand. I don't know.
But that's he burns his hand in the book, and that's like,
that's true.
Yeah, George's that was before the show decided maybe that all Targaryens are immune to fire all the time, or Daenerys is immune to fire all the time. When George's rule is that Targaryens are not immune to fire, it's just that Daenerys was.
I forgot about George's rules.
Yeah, in that scene, because welcome back to Star Wars Spoilers, where Joanna gets pedantic at people. That scene where she burns Khal Drogo,
this is why people
like
showed
all that
up
magic
in the first
was
place,
happening,
so.
And that's why she was immune to fire then. So when she was immune to fire last season, it sort of went against George's rules about Targaryens' immunity and fire. So,
well, there's a lot of stuff in the first season that suggests Daenerys knows or is testing that she's immune to fire. But I wanted to clear this up before we moved on. So the actor that played John Aaron's corpse, John Standing, filmed a scene where he was dying and trying to write a letter confessing the truth about Joffrey's parentage, and Cersei walked in and physically stopped him. That's what I was getting mistaken. So she didn't poison him, but she did stop him from exposing the truth.
Well, that makes
sense.
And I'm pretty sure, but I could be wrong, even though we just all rewatched it, that scene at the beginning, like, it seems like they killed Jon Arryn, but really what they're talking about is the secret of them, like, boning each other and the parentage of Cersei's children getting out. Not like, we killed someone, we have to cover it up. It's like, our secret is the incest that we done did, not the murder that we done did.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
So I would say that scene I would like to go back in, and that if the rumor that they'd shot Brandon Stark and the Mad King for the original pilot,
they definitely shot that. That image exists online, so they definitely shot that. But that's an interesting... That is something very significant that they left out of the first four seasons, which is all the flashback stuff, right? And so, you know, because they were like, we're not doing flashbacks, until they're like, no, we're doing flashbacks. But Dave, you're saying you think that it would have been better if they had done flashbacks in
season
one.
Specifically the Brandon Stark one, because they have to mention that like four different times with four different characters before we even realize that it's all the same series of events under the Mad King. So I feel like if you would have really solidified why a couple of these people dislike each other because of kingly honor and betrayed kingly honor, sort of like how we don't really understand what Kingslayer means until Jaime explains it to us in a later season, but people use it here with the full venom of what it's supposed to mean. I feel like we would have had a better grasp on that if we had seen just the Mad King flashbacks.
Well, there's that scene where Ned comes to King's Landing, and like one of the first things he does is talk to Jaime in the throne room. One of my favorite scenes of the whole series. And, you know, you're right. We're in the first episode, so we're just still trying to figure out like what people's names are even, right? But, you know, there they talk, you know, he's like, you know, is that what you told yourself when you like stabbed Aerys in the back? And Jamie's like, would have been better if I'd stabbed him in the front, and like all this sort of stuff. And there they talk. You're right. It is heavy exposition. Like they talk about Brandon and they talk about Ned's dad and like all the stuff that happened. But it's one of those scenes. It's one of many two-hander scenes that I believe they add to the season because they were short on running time. In every episode, they were 10 minutes short, so they had to, Weiss and Benioff had to construct a bunch of two-hander scenes that they just shoved into episode because they had no budget, but they had to fill the runtime. And I believe this is one of them. And it's just such delicious character work from Jaime and Ned establishing who they are and their weaknesses and their strengths. And you're right that it's exposition, but it's such good exposition versus like the Baelish brothel scene exposition. So.
I mean, I think so, but I don't even think they mentioned that they're actually like lit on fire. I think they just say that like that's a terrible way to die. Like, I don't know if we
that might be true. Yeah,
like get I into like the burn them all thing even until another series. So it's anyway,
no. He says Jamie says burn them all thing when Robert asks Jamie like. They're talking. He and
they're telling war stories.
Oh, yeah, they're talking about who they killed first or whatever. Like guys do, and then Jamie does do the whole burn them all thing.
I do think it's a credit to the writing that some of the best sequences from season one, some of the stuff that really sticks out is just two people talking in an empty throne room. Because then there's the multiple Varys Littlefinger scenes that are just so juicy. Okay, so the other question we had was, so if you could do anything differently in season one, what would it be? I think, Joanna, you had one more note, which I totally agree with, so I wanted to make sure you got to that one.
It's the Roz stuff, which, like, if you've listened to Roz. Me podcast about Game of Thrones for as long as I've been doing it, you know that I am not a fan of Roz, you know, who was supposed to, like... Esme Bianco, who plays Roz, and no knock on Esme Bianco, because she's a fine actress, great on the TV series The Magicians. She was cast as someone called Redheaded Prostitute in the first episode. And then they decided that they liked her so much, they wanted to like sort of expand her role and
give her a name.
And narratively, they felt like they needed someone to like make this journey and then do other, you know, like they needed her for narrative reasons. And in subsequent, I was reading some interviews today, actually, where Weiss, Benioff, and Brian Cogman all sort of bragged about how proud they were of the Roz creation, how they thought it was a really smart way to handle some of the things that they
These are also dudes who have bragged about Ollie, so GTFO, that's all I'm saying.
I thought that was Dave Hill. Isn't Ollie Dave Hill's fault?
They all seem pretty proud of it.
Yeah, Ollie is really just Roz 2.0 with his clothes on. But, you know... I just feel like now they realize that they don't need Roz. Roz is like not just a narrative device, but like a really super sexy narrative device. And I feel like the show is actually a little bit better. You know, I've talked about how the show is leaning more towards spectacle now, but I think the show is a little bit better maybe because we probably shame-nunned them about it. But like... is a little bit better about this person's taking their clothes off because you want to see tits, you know? They try to make the nudity and that sort of stuff more organic to the scene you're watching and not just like TNA for TNA's sake.
It does feel like, you know, you mentioned how they had to pad some of the episodes. It does feel like a lot of that is filler now. When you go back and really watch it, like the Littlefinger scene where he's got Roz and the other girl and he's like coaching them on being prostitutes. I didn't remember it going on as long as it does. Like, when I watched it again, I was like, this is going on forever. Like, this doesn't feel like now on Game of Thrones, we still get some nudity. We still get, you know, some sexy time, except a lot of it's just very hurried. But, like, that scene goes on forever. And maybe it was just they tried to pad it out, and it was good for the brand. At that point in season one, it was good for the Game of Thrones. We're going to chop off some heads and show you a lot of tits brand.
Right. And I feel like now they're like, we don't need to do that. We already got you hooked. We don't have to kind of debase ourselves a little bit like we did in season one and season two. But, you know, and that scene is sort of where, you know, we get the term sex position from, right? Because Baelish is telling the story of like, him growing up, right? And we need to know
right,
that.
And him fighting Brandon Stark.
Right, and we need to know that about Baelish. It's important to know Baelish's character, but, like, it's just sad that they thought we needed, like, two ladies, you know, going to town on each other in order to, like, keep our attention in that scene.
I wouldn't go all the way to sad. Sorry.
Well, it's underestimating the audience, right?
It's my internal dude. It's like, well, it's not that sad. But yeah, I mean, it does underestimate the intelligence of the audience. But again, it was very on brand at the time. Mm-hmm. So,
okay, we just get a fan produced short of that actual story this week, right?
Yeah, which is really good, by the way.
I haven't bookmarked, but I've yet to sit down and digest the whole thing. But I'm into it.
I haven't watched it either. It's the story of like how Littlefinger got scarred by Brandon Stark and stuff.
It's basically a Brandon Stark short film.
Oh, cool.
But anyway, I agree with you on the Roz stuff. I don't miss it, and it feels weird now going back to watch it again.
Especially how she ended, too. Like, the knowing
very as we do now,
like, how it all ended, you're just like, ugh. Because, like, what, you know, there's a certain point when you're like, oh, Roz is a bookkeeper now, Littlefinger. Oh, moving up in the world,
she
Roz.
Made
okay.
It.
And then it's like, no, you're just a naked lady who's brutally murdered to prove a point about how bad a dude is. And I'm like, all right, that's good.
Cool. Okay. What did we like? Is there one more thing that we liked about the rewatch?
Yeah, the thought. Sorry. Go ahead, Dave.
Oh, no. I'm interested in what you have to say first.
Oh, I feel like I just monologued for a while, but I will just say that this prompt was my idea, right? Which is like something you remember not liking that you like when you watch it now. Speaks to like, we're all 6 or 7 years older than we were when we watched it the first time. We're different people, et cetera, et cetera. I will say that every time I rewatch this show, and I would say this is probably my fourth time through, probably, I love the Lannisters more than I, you know, when you start the series and you're like, Lannister's bad, Stark good. But, you know, knowing what we know now about Jaime and Cersei, like every single thing. And the fact that Nicola Coster-Waldau and Lena Headey are so good in everything they do, just every single thing that Cersei and Jaime say in season one, I was just like, yes, you're great. I love you. So, me reevaluating the Lannister twins.
It's funny because mine is similar, but mine is more with Tywin Lannister. Like, every moment that Charles dances on screen in the show is delicious.
Sure,
like,
is
just living deliciously. And I feel like we... as I watched it the first time, when I originally watched it, because I actually had watched the first season without reading the books, I very much underestimated how important Tywin Lannister was. Like, he just felt like this background presence, and then he kind of just shows up, and it really wasn't until, like, season 3 where you're really like, oh, this guy really is running shit. And it's so much better to go back and watch him again, because he's just so good from moment one. I feel the same way about Varys. Like, knowing Varys's, like, long game makes a lot of his early stuff make a lot more sense.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I'm just going to go with that, even though I feel like my answer is like the lamer version of that, which is that knowing the end points of all these people made me a lot more attentive to their beginning points, and characters that I hated or that I thought were boring suddenly were given a full background, which is like, you know, I understand would be your guys' or a book reader's initial experience, because I know sometimes that's happened to me with new Star Wars, where I'm like, that's that thing from that book. So I had the watered down version of that, where that's that thing I remember from being obsessed with it, what it becomes, you know, 5 years down the line.
I am curious to see if that happens with Stannis. I never liked Stannis as a character, book or screen, but I wonder if I'll appreciate him more knowing that there's an end point to it.
It does make a lot of the things that Melisandre says to him more interesting, but we'll save that for
next week. But Dave, like, so what's a boring character from season one that, like, now you're like, oh?
What's a boring character from season one that now I'm like, oh, yeah. Bran?
Yeah.
Because, like, he's having prophetic dreams in a world that, as far as I know, is without magic. And he just wakes up and he's like, I don't remember the one thing that my character was supposed to remember, and I can't walk. And then it's like he, you know, makes weird decisions being carried around Winterfell and wants to die. Bran is really boring in season one. But knowing that he actually is magic makes me pay more attention to what he's being told and what he's saying.
Yeah. On that list, Sir Alistair Thorne. Also kind of on that list. Not Ollie, because he's not around yet.
Pip, no. For sure. No, I'm just kidding. You're fine, right. Pip. You're fine.
So I think it's time for us to give away some Georgie Awards.
Right.
Which is something that we've done in the past, right? We did this once, right? I didn't just make up the fact that we did this once
you
in
guys
my
did
mind.
It, you guys did it with Patches, like,
okay.
When I was gone.
Oh,
I
yeah, just... people love that episode.
Yeah, we should definitely keep doing things that we did with during that episode. Anyway, so the Georgie Awards, for every one of the first six seasons, we're going to give away in a few categories. Some of these categories are actually going to change as we go along because some of these things change. But the first thing we're going to do is Best Death. And this is just sort of the, I don't know, most memorable, however you want to define Best Death. And we'll start with Joanna.
I had the obvious one down, which is Ned Stark, because sure. It's like, how do you compete with that? But then I changed it. I mean, I'm going to talk about Ned plenty more before this episode's over. Don't you worry. But the reason why I changed it is because rewatching the pilot, I really love the cold open with the Night's Watch guys. And, you know, this is something that every Game of Thrones, every Game of Thrones book starts with a POV character that either then dies or it's just like someone who's not back. This is George Special is the first chapter or the prologue or whatever is a POV of a non-main character. And I always think that that's a really fun thing. You kind of don't even know who you're with until like halfway through the chapter and all this sort of stuff. And it just feels like a kind of exploration of a side character that Game of Thrones, the show, would not do now. I don't feel like we get a lot of like quirky side characters. I could be wrong, but side characters who won't be like they're out of time, you know, is the most charitable interpretation. They're out of time. They don't have time for like quirky side characters that are not going to like mean a lot later. These guys mean a lot because they establish the White Walker threat. Their death means a lot. But I was thinking of then in the finale of the season, this isn't a death, but there's that whole sequence with the bard who like sings this whole song that's insulting to Cersei about Robert Baratheon, blah, blah, blah. And then Joffrey has his tongue cut out. It's really there to kind of show you Joffrey's a terrible little shitty tyrant. But we already knew that. He just killed Ned. And it just spends a lot of time with his bard, who then we never see again. It's not Marillion. It's just a random bard. And so space for people like that, I think, is really interesting and why I vote for that opening death.
Nice. Dave, do you have a best death?
Best death. I mean, I think Viserys' death is probably the best.
I forget about Viserys a lot.
Well, the only reason I'd say the two deaths that come back to me the most in season one are actually both because of audio cues. Viserys, because of the clunk his head makes when he falls down.
Yes.
And then the baby that's killed off screen has such a specific, one of the Robert's bastards has such a specific.
Oh, that's in season two. Save that one.
That's
for
in
next
season
week.
Two. Okay, I'll save that. Good sound, though. Think about that sound.
Baby dying.
Also, oh, no, wait, no, that's something else. I was going to say something about Syrio, but
there's a great sound cue with the Syrio thing, but it sounds like a Wilhelm scream.
Yeah, there's like a generic cry. It's like, that could be anyone.
Okay.
Right. We know it's not Ser Meron, unfortunately.
Neil, what is your answer?
Yes. Okay. So mine is the guy, the just sort of indiscriminate dude who is going to stab Bran. I think in the second episode?
Yeah, the assassin.
And really why I love it is not necessarily because, it's super gory and Summer rips out his throat, but it also made me like tear up because I was like, they do the shot where he kills him and Catelyn's just sitting there and she's like, her hands are all bloody and she's in shock. And the dog just gets back up on the bed and lays down. And I'm just like, oh shit, the dog's going to be with him until the dog gets killed, which is something we lived through last season. So it was post-traumatic stress combined with like, it's like, oh my God, that dog, it's such a sweet moment. It's one of those knowing the end game makes the beginning more interesting things. So, but also it's the first like super brutal death. I mean, I know the guy in the opening gets his head chopped off, but like this one is like blood soaked crazy. And I really like it. I think that that's a very underrated scene, and it's another one of those little breadcrumbs that is just there in the first season where you're just like, man, that is going to come back to just punch you in the heart later when that dog dies, saving Bran.
Everything about the dire wolves when they could actually afford to show the dire wolves is pretty heart-wrenching.
Oh, we should say R.A.P. the real wolf who played Ghost died this last week. I almost said something like I don't want to like
downer.
I don't want to like get entangled in like the sadness of an animal dying, but I almost said something snarky like not like they were going to use him anyway because they forgot that even he fucking exists. But yeah, the scene in the pilot where they find the direwolf puppies. I mean, come on, that's great television.
Yeah,
and Theon being such a little asshole and wanting to kill direwolf puppies, and Bran being so adorable, and then Jon finding the albino one and picking it up and just sort of like not being affectionate towards it, just sort of being like, what is this?
Anyway. I guess I have this now.
Yeah.
And Ned being super fatherly. Like, there's a lot of that in season one.
Ned being like, basically, you're going to have to walk it and feed it yourself, like any dad would say. And and then Rob just being, I was watching some of these episodes with my roommate who loves Game of Thrones, and she's just like, Rob is just this gemstone of a human being, and it pains me to watch him exist. And I was like,
that is really one of the secret sauce of the Red Wedding is how great of a character Rob is.
Yeah.
Like, you just root for that guy the whole way.
You really do.
But we'll get to that when we get to season 3. If you had to pick a most memorable line, what would it be? Dave, you could start us off this time.
You think my life is such a precious thing to me that I would trade my honor for a few more years of what? Because that is literally the last time that someone makes that decision in Game of Thrones.
I love that line. Yeah. I love that line. That line and sort of Aemon's speech, because it's in that video that I watched 1,000 times.
Oh, like it's easy for a man to do his duty when it's like he's not called upon. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
That video that I was touting last season, that like someone put together a supercut of all the scenes that show, you know, that Lyanna is Jon's father and how it like was from the beginning, and that interaction of Ned with Varys in the Black Cells, and then also Aemon's speech, they're both about honor. So sort of to establish, you know, because he's like, do you think it's easy to do the things, like, you know, to not go fight for your, you know, because Jon wants to go fight for Rob, to not go fight for your brother. I didn't go fight for my brother. This is the vow we took. These are the honor, you know, it's easy to, anyway. Those really hit me hard watching this time. I think that's a great choice, Dave.
Thank you.
Joanna, what's yours?
Sorry, I didn't mean to be like, good job, you picked the right one. Okay. War was easier than daughters, which is a Ned Stark line that I love.
Very Ned dadness.
This ties into, I'll talk more about this, but just like how much I love how much of season one is like this domestic story of a single dad with two daughters trying to make it in the workplace.
She doesn't like my doll, and the other one wants to be a boy.
You know, because that episode, also, that's the episode that also ends with, I mean, Sansa's being a little shit about the, like, he's like, he's so sweet when he gives her that doll. And he's like, it's the same one that, you know, Princess Marcella has. Do you love it? And then Sansa's being a little brat. And then his lovely scene with Arya in her bedroom, which is just like killer. And then the end, you know, when he hires Ciryl, sorry, motorcycle just went by. Where he hires Sirio, and then you also hear like the sound of wars. It's just Dad Ned is very, very important to this series. Mm-hmm. So
nice. And mine is a Daenerys line, because what I forget, and we're about to live through this with the next two seasons, is that Daenerys gets super boring for a super long time. But her season one arc is really great. How she goes from essentially being sold off like a piece of meat to being very much the victim of her marriage, to falling in love, to then asserting herself. And there's the line when Viserys dies where she's like, he was no dragon. Fire cannot kill a dragon. It's basically like that's her kind of turning moment where she realizes that she's the real last dragon. And she may not have figured it out completely yet. You know, she doesn't necessarily go jumping into a fire pit. But this, you really do see the evolution. And I thought that it's also sort of this great evolution in Emilia Clarke's performance throughout the first season, because she's real stiff at the beginning. And by the end of the season, she really, like, she just starts to just come out of her shell, which I thought was just great. So that line just works.
Yeah.
Also, it's, you know, it's cool because Viserys he sucks. Never liked that guy. He's actually, it's funny, I made mention of this on Twitter, and I feel a lot of people agreed with me. There are reasons to miss Joffrey and Ramsay. And there's another person that I hate, that everyone hated, that I can't remember. Who am I missing? Who's the other bad guy? Doesn't matter. Joffrey and Ramsay.
Yeah.
There's no reason to miss Viserys. He's just...
I disagree.
Shitty.
I disagree.
Really?
I really love Joffrey and Viserys in... I think of them as two of a kind. They're just these... shitty, terrible, petty people. And that's not the kind of villain we have on Game of Thrones anymore. We have, like, a king of ice zombies now.
Right, we have, instead, like, pure evil.
Yeah, instead
and then
of...
evil.
And then there's, like, Cersei, who's not, like, pure evil at all. Like, Cersei's kind of, like, this sympathetic, steel-in-her-spine bitch. Like, you know, we love rooting for Cersei, but Joffrey and Viserys was just, like... you know, like our freaking president, just like terrible, terrible humans, terrible men,
petulant children.
The evil deeds of petty men and women too, if you want. And that's why I like it. It's just it's rooted, like Viserys is recognizable to me. His villainy versus the Night's King, I'm like, what is this massive wall of evil? I don't know, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I get it. That makes a lot of sense. I spent all of the Viserys scenes in my rewatch like, oh, God, just kill this guy already.
Yeah. I'm going to use this as a way to pivot into our next topic, because I pick Jack Gleeson, who plays Joffrey, as my MVP of season one, because it isn't until the last episode that you actually realize he's a sociopath. Because of his, I don't know, his face and his performance, and the fact that he is allowed to make mistakes in front of Robert and get slapped around by Tyrion early in the season, is really much more of a ramping effect. And he doesn't come out as like a full-on sociopath, I don't think, until season two. But the sudden sharp turn that power leads into cruelty, I'm going to give to child actor, who made me believe he was like neutrally... a weird character I was supposed to laugh at, and then suddenly steps in to become the villain in one episode.
That's a good one.
Yeah, no, and I think you're right. And sort of watching the way that Cersei indulges him, like the thing she tells him, like that great scene where she's like, you know, if you want painted whores, you will have painted whores because you are my precious son and you will just get whatever you want. And you're like, oh, How to Build a Monster, 10 Easy Steps by Cersei Lannister. This is not going to end well. So that's a good pick. And Jack Gleeson's great. I was so sad when Joffrey died. Spoiler alert.
That is one that...
that's 3 weeks from now, Joanna.
Okay, so Joanna, the MVP is meant to be a character, an actor, a writer, a director, a DP, whatever.
I'm giving it to Weiss and Benioff, because as hard as I am on them now, I want to give them credit then for a couple things. One is doing the show in the first place, loving the book and wanting to do the show and convincing George that they were the people to do it. The other is they shot a shitty pilot. All their friends told them they were shitty, and they fixed it. The pilot is great by their reports and everyone else's reports. Their original was bad. So I really respect people who do something bad and figure out how to fix it. And then sort of what I mentioned before in terms of those little two-handers that they like scrambled to write and shove in to stuff up the holes of this season, like... I know people don't like the scene where Cersei talks to Robert about like their child, because they either feel it makes Cersei too sympathetic, or it introduces introduces this inconsistency of like Cersei losing her child with him, like that's not in the books, so what is this and all this sort of stuff. But I love that scene, and I love all of those scenes. That Deadline article that I mentioned, where Weiss and Benioff are talking about this thing that they had to do, they are very proud of it. And they were talking about how it really felt like the first time their adaptation kind of it's how I feel about episode 4 of American Gods this week. This first time the adaptation really felt like something they were owning versus just like sort of very faithfully adapting what George had written. And I think that was the right sentiment at the time. Like, they were writing these scenes that were very grounded in character. They weren't like big plot altering scenes. They were just like, let's write some fun dialogue that really is connected to these characters that we understand very well. And I feel like they've lost the it's not their fault that they don't have books to adapt anymore, but I also feel like in certain ways they've lost the thread on their understanding of some of the characters in some of the ways in which they've adapted this. So I feel like that really good thing that they did in season one is now sort of run amok, but back in season one they just really nailed the things that they add. Oh, like the Tywin, butchering that stag is something that they added last minute to throughout the running time. That's one of the greatest introductions of a character ever. So kudos to them. Kudos to Weiss and Benioff for the work that they did on season one of Game of Thrones.
Nice. Mine's related to that. Sort of.
Is it the stag?
Oh man, that stag. It could be Charles Dance, but it's not. It's old Gurm himself, George R. R. Martin. Because you're right. Everything you said about Weiss and Benioff is spot on in how they adapted it. But I think that the shows, the first season, there's two things that struck out to me that feel very George. One is all the breadcrumbs that pay off so much later that are just so beautifully woven into the story. Like, he was very, very meticulous in making it all work. And then it creates this, I think a lot of the best stuff, a lot of this character work sort of is them resting on this foundation that he built with the first book. So, I think, and it would be easy. He's like the LeBron James of Game of Thrones. You could give him the MVP for like all the seasons that were directly adapted from books.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think the first one is the most important because there's a lot of vision in there. Like, I was so surprised at how much is in there that is stuff that is just like how many times they talk about Lyanna Stark and all this stuff that has just recently paid off or is about to pay off in season 7. You really have to give a lot of credit to George for that. So he's my season 1 MVP.
Awesome.
Yeah. All right. So the next one is Dave's expertise.
Yes.
Which is best and worst polygons. So Dave, we're going to let you take the lead on this one. What was the best use of polygons and the worst use of polygons in season 1?
It's hard to call the best, but I'm going to say for sure the worst is Vias Dothrak that we actually go to. And I'd forgotten that we go to it because that's how poorly it's established / matte painted, whatever the hell they do with their wooden horse arch, which gets, revisited later on in the series and actually feels like a giant place. But here feels like one tent with no room to even do matte paintings in the background for some reason. So it's all at night, and the tent cities lead to another tent. It's not great. They could have expanded that out. And I guess best... Oh, I don't know. I think that a lot of the... I don't know. I kind of want to go with however they accomplished both polygon and practical effects, the mountain beheading his horse, just because
that's a good one.
That's so visceral. I remember watching it the first time when it happened, and it doesn't get less visceral when it goes. Plus, I don't want to pick what I think, Neil, you thought was the best, and I can't necessarily argue with.
Yeah, and I think this one, I think mine is also a mix of practical and digital, which is the baby dragons at the end. Because that is really the oh shit moment right at the end, where it's just like, oh my god, there really are dragons in this world. Like, magic is real. Everything we know is upside down. And those dragons look really great. There are moments later in the series where the dragons look less great, but they really nailed it, and it does feel like they saved all their budget for it. So I think the dragons are my best. I noticed that a lot of the stuff at the top of the wall looks weird. Not the shots of them peering over the wall, but like shots where like two characters are talking at the top of the wall.
Yeah.
And they just kind of had to shoot it weird because they didn't, it doesn't seem like they had the budget to do all the, you know, the wonderful vistas and the shots. Like you go, if you were to watch the shots of John and Benjen talking at the top of the wall and then immediately go watch the Watchers on the Wall episode, there's just, it's night and day. Mm. Literally, one takes place at night, one takes place in the day.
Figured out they should film that shit at night.
Right. So the wall stuff, like the first time you see the wall, it looks like a matte painting. And then every other time you see the wall, it's just not right. So those are mine. But Joanna, what are your best and worst polygons?
Yeah, I watched, because I feel so like poorly qualified to comment on polygons, I watched this YouTube video that's like season one special effects. It's just one of those things where like they show you the thing and then they show you what they matte painted and you're like, well, that was a green screen. Oh my God. All of Winterfell is a green screen. Oh my God. So Vice to Throck was definitely on there. The wall, Benjen and John on top of the wall is definitely on there. So looking at that all, I was like, you know what? The eerie from the outside, I think, is the worst matte painting. The map, mattiest in the matte paintings that they do. The best to me, though, is actually part of the eerie, which is the sky cell, because I can't watch that scene without getting like vertigo. And that's really Peter Dinklage, like, just a few feet off the ground. But just the, like the concept of the sky cell and the sloped floor is genius. Good job, George. And then I thought they just executed it really well. So
it is when you mention it, the whole everything about the eerie from the inside is really great. Like the set design of that whole set is great. The Moondor stuff is great.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. That first shot of it when they look up at the eerie, it's like, wait, what?
Yeah. Did Thomas Kinkade, a Master of Light, paint this?
Well, they changed that, right? Because it doesn't have the neck bottleneck throughway that becomes a big deal later on, right?
Yeah, they sort of changed the design of it from the book to the show.
And then in later seasons, I think you're right.
Yeah, like in the books, there's no like stairs to the eerie. You have to like go up a basket, but the show just could not be bothered with that.
There's stairs and a basket. Getting up to the eerie description in the book is insanity.
Right.
It's like, I think you have to get on a mule and then the mule is no longer okay. And then, yeah, it is crazy. But no, I think, Dave, you're referring to like the place where like Arya and the Hound go and they're like,
oh, yeah,
just
the
kidding,
gate.
Your aunt's dead.
Right.
And Arya forgets
I don't think that's in the
about her sister.
Yeah, I don't think that's in the matte painting.
Yeah, it's not.
Joanna, you did in the notes mention one thing that I super agree with, which is those White Walkers at the beginning.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of that is practical, which I think is why it works so well.
Yeah, it's guys in suits, I think. Yeah. Or guys in suits in the dark. And then later when you see him in season two, that's when they've switched to like the cat face CGI. And now like, I think they're back to guys in suits. But there was a time
the ones in season in Hard Home are... like those are the best version.
Yeah, I agree. Nice. But like between season one and Hard Home, the White Walker design was rough stuff.
Nice.
But in the very first episode, it's like a guy in the dark and his like eyes are glowy, and that's what you see.
All right, so our second to last award, mine's gonna be quick. This is best performance, which I think as we move along, it'll probably be more of a like a most improved performance thing, because they don't introduce a ton of new characters every season. But mine, very quickly, is Conleth Hill, who plays Varys. Because I didn't notice the first time around how he just brings it from the beginning. Like, yeah. Varys is just awesome the whole time. And other characters, like I said, Emilia Clarke, Peter Dinklage, it sort of takes some time to get into their character. Some of them never get the accent right. But like Conleth Hill is just fantastic from the first scene. So I would say that he's my best performance. What Joanna, you got the one that I think everyone's going to agree with.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of people would say Peter Dinklage is, but that's not mine. Mine is Sean Bean. Which does seem like a duh obvious thing, but here's the deal. And we talked about this a little bit before, but, the juice of season one of Game of Thrones is this, like, you're on a hero's journey and then you get the rug pulled out from under you. And so in order for that juice to really work, we need to care so much about Ned Stark for his death to land the way that it does in episode 9. And because you get 9 episodes. It's not like a character that's been on for years and you're like, oh no, it's like you get 9 episodes with this guy where also the story has to do a lot of other things in the meantime. And so Sean Bean like really needs to kill it. And it can't just be like, oh, I know that guy from Lord of the Rings. Like he really needs to inhabit Ned. And I just rewatching this, I was just like, everything he does, all that dad stuff that we mentioned,
the motorcycles agree.
You know, all the dad stuff that he mentioned, like all this other stuff. I just think it's vital. It's vital to the success of Game of Thrones that we care about Ned, that he's not just sort of like a carbon, like a cardboard hero, that he's like a very interesting figure that we're following, and then for him to be gone, and then we feel that loss for the rest of the show. And I think, you know, not to sort of alienate our listeners further by negatively comparing our current season to the first season, but some of the heroes, most of the heroes that we have now, like our main heroes with a like capital H sort of thing, are Daenerys and Jon Snow, right? And yeah. I think Emilia Clarke and Kit Harington are two of the weakest performers in this show. So I think they've gotten better with as the show has gone on, but like I just don't think I think that they are leagues behind what Sean Bean is doing in the hero with a capital H role in the first season. And so that's another thing that pales by comparison. Like I don't feel for Jon Snow the way that I know a lot of viewers do. And maybe if he had come back as a wolf, I would feel differently, but I don't. So.
I almost suspect that that's going to be something we'll experience more with season 2 and season 3 as we get into them. The idea that the show, a lot of the people, big deaths in the show are, it's not that I miss the characters quite so much as I miss those actors. And there's some amazing actors that have come and then been dispatched by Game of Thrones. And you sort of miss those presences. Like, I don't miss Tywin Lannister, but I miss Charles Dance.
Yeah.
So I'm exactly. curious to see how that plays out for season 2, 3, and 4.
And so, like, I mean, I like Maisie Williams a lot, and I like Sophie Turner, too. But, like, yeah, the Stark kids are now who we're following, and they're maybe not even the best Stark kids. Pour one out for Rickon. Like, the promise of Rickon that's established in the first season of, like, this is a weird kid who just, like, hangs out in crypts sometimes.
Has wolf dreams.
He's going to do something interesting. Nope, just kidding. Nope. It
can't
won't
even
matter.
Run the zigzag. Anyway. Dave, who's your best performance?
I agree with Joanna for the most part, but I'm going to go with the flip side, the connection to the old world that we never got to see of Game of Thrones that we saw through performance. It was delivered in one season by Mark Addy, who plays Robert Baratheon.
Yes. He's a good
is
one.
Very welcome, especially now that I know that I am never going to see another person like having won a war, sitting legitimately on the throne, probably in this series until the very end. So considering that he has to provide a whole character arc and a whole bunch of exposition in, he only gets 7 episodes, is pretty good. Good job, Mark.
I agree.
He's so joyous.
He's great.
Robert Baratheon, but also such a dick.
And his bad lip reading is the best.
He's like, all right. His like being lovesick over Lyanna is so good.
Mm-hmm.
He like the fact that he knows that his son is a monster is good.
Then he looks Cersei in the eye and says, "There was never a point that I was going to love you."
Yeah,
it's devastating and great.
Ugh. Yep.
Or like him just shit talking Lancel Lannister. He's like, "What the fuck is your name even, Lancel? It's a
what
terrible
the fuck
name.
Even are you?
Also, what do you mean there's no more wine? How dare you?"
God, Lancel, he turned out to be a real shit. Okay, final award, which I'm going to say this before I say the name of the award, is this award may not make it through the entire series, but we're believers in it, and it could live on forever. But this is the Catelyn Stark Memorial Most Ironic Statement Award.
Which... I don't think it has to be Catelyn Stark to say it. It's just like in the spirit of season one, Catelyn Stark, who was forever saying this shit.
Yep. So this is a quote that comes back to bite a character.
Yeah.
Much later. Dave, go ahead and start us off with your quote.
Mine is from Catelyn Stark, and it's sort of the meta of the quotes. In the name of King Robert and the good lords you serve, I call upon you to seize him and help me return him to Winterfell to await the king's justice, is the line Catelyn starts the War of the Five Kings with.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's also her saying it about Tyrion, and none of that happens.
None of that happens. Yep.
Joanna, you have a good one as well.
Yeah, you said a line that comes back to bite them in the ass way further down the road. This is a pretty immediate ass biting for Catelyn Stark. It's when she's in the brothel with Ned and Lord Baelish, and she says, she's talking about Lord Baelish, she says, "He's like a little brother to me, Ned. He would never betray my trust." There's a great YouTube video that someone has made at this moment where they just repeat her saying, "He's like a little brother to me," and the camera just keeps zooming in closer and closer on Littlefinger's face. Because, like, not only is she very wrong about this, but also, like, maybe her just even saying that pushed Littlefinger to betray Ned harder than he might have otherwise done, because Catelyn called him a little brother, and he's like, "Oh, I'll show you, little brother." Ugh. Anyway, that's my
point. I feel like what we're going to end up getting with this award is the revelation that Catelyn Stark is responsible for everything.
That's see, that was what a lot of people felt in the first couple seasons. Catelyn Stark was sort of the Skyler White of Game of Thrones for a little while. So,
mine, which is, I mean, I almost fell off the couch because I, one, forgot that this line was in there, and two, it's the worst one. Where they are outside the twins talking strategy with Rob, and she volunteers to go talk to Lord Walder, and she says, "I've known Lord Walder since I was a girl. He would never hurt me."
Catelyn, why so wrong all the time?
Oh, Catelyn. Oh, you poor, sweet summer child. So those are the Catelyn Stark Memorial Most Iconic Statement Awards.
Yeah. I feel like in season four, it'll still be the Catelyn Stark Memorial, but we'll have a ton of, like, I don't know, reek things that were said, and it'll all be horrible.
Or R.I.P. Prince Oberyn sayings.
Yeah, R.I.P. Prince Oberyn sayings.
I can wait for that one.
Well, guys, I think that's going to do it for season one. Neil, you have an awesome season two phrase written here. Here's our season two phrase from Mr. Neil Miller.
Yes. So next week we are going to be exploring my low-key favorite season, which is season two. But we have in season two, you can expect among the following: Baratheon brothers, a red woman, Tyrion as the Hand, Joffrey the Shit, smoke monsters, and other stuff. So I cannot wait to talk about season two, because the more we dig into this, the more I'm like, man, I really like season two. So
what I have learned by enjoying the season one rewatch so much that I immediately had to go into season two is the benefit of being able to rewatch these in a binge manner and live in the world for hours at a time is so much better than not having any idea what's going
to
happen.
It really makes me excited to go back to... The only thing that makes me excited to go back to season six is the idea of watching it all at once and seeing how that's different.
So, like, Karth isn't as bad as you may remember it being, because we had weeks of Where Are My Dragons, and here you maybe have 2 hours of it. So next week, your homework assignment is to watch the second season of Game of Thrones. Until then, let's say I wanted to hear about some Star Wars. Joanna Robinson, where would I do that?
Oh, you might want to tune into the podcast Little Gold Men, the Vanity Fair podcast, where we talk about a lot of Star Wars and some Twin Peaks. Or you might want to go to vanityfair.com to read about Star Wars. Or you might want to follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This, where I will be babbling about Star Wars.
Sounds good. Mr. Neil Miller.
No, wait. Tomorrow's the Star Wars anniversary, so I will be writing about Star Wars this week. over at filmschoolrejects.com, where you can also find me. I'm going to do a little Game of Thrones weekly column leading up to, in conjunction, it's a side column to this podcast, which is going to be fun. That's filmschoolrejects.com. That's the website. I said that. You can also follow me on Twitter at Rejects. Make sure you follow our show at Storm of Spoilers. And if you have any emails, because we know you guys want to send, you've been waiting all off season to send us emails about Game of Thrones. Now is your chance. Stormofspoilers@gmail.com.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can find the rest of my podcast work at fightinginthewarroom.com. Please tweet me about the superheroes, Twin Peaks, television, whatever stuff that you're watching, because I need something to push back the news that tries to rush in when I open up Twitter. So help me out with that, guys. And until next time, welcome back to Westeros.